This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. So one day, a few years ago, an MIT professor named Cheri Turkle saw something that would change almost everything she believed, because up until that point, Cheri Turkle was the poster child for the tech revolution, literally.
I was on the cover of Wired magazine.
The April 1996 issue. And she was a total evangelist for all the new ways we were interacting with technology.
My idea was that we would use what we learned in the virtual world to better our lives in the real world.
Anyway, that day, Cheri went to a nursing home. It was outside Boston. And she went there to see something absolutely amazing. Cheri and her graduate students would watch an elderly patient at that home interact with a robot, a sociable robot named Paro.
It looked like a baby harp seal.
Okay.
It had fur, it had big eyes with large eyelashes.
Pretty eyes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It knew language enough to respond sort of appropriately.
Yeah, how are you?
If you were sad, it made, you know, kind of comforting sad noises.
You are sweetie, you know.
I mean, it was designed to comfort the elderly. And this robot was with an older woman who'd lost a child. And there was a group of us standing around, my research assistants, the head of the nursing home, bunch of nurses, to watch the reaction of this older woman. And she was pouring out her heart about losing this child. And she was comforted by this robot. This robot made her feel understood.
It was amazing. The researchers couldn't believe how well this old woman was responding to a robot, to Paro.
I looked around and saw that this was being appreciated as progress.
Everyone who was in that room started to imagine the possibilities. Paro as friend to old people, to lonely people, to kids in hospitals. Cheri Turkle was right there, and she was watching it all happen right before her eyes.
And I felt profoundly depressed. This was a tremendous emotional turning point for me in my research.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, my robot, my friend, my replacement, the promise and the peril of how we relate to our technology. We're going to hear from TED speakers who all believe this new technology is starting to change who we are as humans, who we actually are. Some say for the better and some for the worse. So Cheri Turkle, as you've probably guessed, is really worried about where all this is headed. And when she gave her TED Talk, she described that moment watching this old woman pouring her heart out to a robotic seal.
I felt myself at the cold, hard center of a perfect storm. We expect more from technology and less from each other. And I ask myself, why have things come to this? And I believe it's because technology appeals to us most where we are most vulnerable. And we are vulnerable. We're lonely, but we're afraid of intimacy. And so from social networks to sociable robots, we're designing technologies that will give us the illusion of companionship without the demands of friendship. We turn to technology to help us feel connected in ways we can comfortably control. But we're not so comfortable. We are not so much in control.
Isn't there a part of you that looked at that interaction and thought it was amazing? I mean, here was this woman who had suffered a profound loss at some point in her life. She had lost a child, and she was responding to this robot. And it might not have been real, but it was real to her.
Well, no, I don't think it's amazing. And what was extraordinary to me is that although she was surrounded by people who were in a position to understand her story, we were kind of applauding and stepping back and cheering on her connection to a machine that understood nothing. And I really felt, what are we doing? Why are we essentially outsourcing the thing that defines us as people? You know, we care for our young, we care for our old, and outsourcing it to something that we knew was essentially deceiving her by tricks into thinking that it cared for her at all. You know, that was how.
So when Sherry Turkle gave her TED Talk last year, it was like a public confessional because 15 years earlier, she also gave a TED Talk, a very different one. It was a talk about how social technology would help us become better, more productive human beings. But then she changed her mind.
Over the past 15 years, I've studied technologies of mobile communication, and I've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, young and old, about their plugged-in lives. And what I've found is that our little devices, those little devices in our pockets, are so psychologically powerful that they don't only change what we do, they change who we are. Some of the things we do now with our devices are things that only a few years ago we would have found odd or disturbing, but they've quickly come to seem familiar. People text or do email during corporate board meetings. They text and shop and go on Facebook during classes, during presentations, actually during all meetings. People talk to me about the important new skill of making eye contact while you're texting. People explain to me that it's hard, but that it can be done. Parents text and do email at breakfast and at dinner while their children complain about not having their parents' full attention, but then these same children deny each other their full attention. And we even text at funerals. I study this. We remove ourselves from our grief or from our reverie, and we go into our phones. Why does this matter? It matters to me because I think we're setting ourselves up for trouble. Trouble certainly in how we relate to each other, but also trouble in how we relate to ourselves, in our capacity for self-reflection. We're getting used to a new way of being alone together. People want to be with each other, but also elsewhere, connected to all the different places they want to be. People want to customize their lives. They want to go in and out of all the places they are because the thing that matters most to them is control over where they put their attention. So you want to go to that board meeting, but you only want to pay attention to the bits that interest you. And some people think that's a good thing. But you can end up hiding from each other even as we're all constantly connected to each other.
Okay, Sherry, can I just pause here for a sec?
Uh-huh.
What if someone is so lonely and their loneliness can be resolved by having a robot or, you know, some device to talk to? I mean, shouldn't we let them have that?
Well, I think that, you know, look, I'm not the Grinch. You know, I'm not here. I mean, let me be realistic. I don't want to be in the position of the Grinch denying the loneliest person on the planet an entity to chat with. But, you know, what are they chatting about? What is it to suggest chatting with an entity that has no idea what you're saying? So the question is, why would we want to do that to ourselves, to construct false relationships? Because when we construct robots, we are changing ourselves. We are changing what we are willing to consider a relationship.
But this is happening, Sherry. I mean, this is, you have students, you have had students over your career who are now doing this, who are working counter to everything that you are now talking about. And I'm wondering how we avoid this thing that you're worried about. How do you avoid it now?
I don't really see myself as the boy with his finger in the dike. My job is not to stop the research or say, you know, people who are doing this research are, you know, are bad people. Or I'm just saying I want to hear a more articulated conversation about what are the human values, what are the real needs that we're serving.
So, Sherry, later in the show, we're going to hear from some of your colleagues at MIT who, you know, make you seem like an outlier.
I know that when I have conversations with my colleagues or listen to TED Talks that talk about this, they always end with, if we let robots do the job, we will become more human. That's how it always ends. We will become more human. We will become more human. I'm not so sure. I think playing with our pets is something that kind of matters. And why do we want all these robot pets around? Why do we want that old woman talking to a robot? I think that at the end of life, when she wants to reflect on her life, she deserves to have people around who understand what a life is. And quite frankly, I think we need to hear the stories of her life to learn from her.
Technology is making a bid to redefine human connection, how we care for each other, how we care for ourselves, but it's also giving us the opportunity to affirm our values and our direction. I'm optimistic. We have everything we need to start. We have each other, and we have the greatest chance of success if we recognize our vulnerability, that we listen when technology says it will take something complicated and promises something simpler. But our fantasies of substitution have cost us. Now we all need to focus on the many, many ways technology can lead us back to our real lives, our own bodies, our own communities, our own politics, our own planet. They need us. Let's talk about how we can use digital technology, the technology of our dreams, to make this life the life we can love. Thank you.
Sherry Turkle, she's at MIT. 1.5 million people have watched her full TED Talk. You can too at TED.com. My robot, my friend, my replacement, we're talking about how our technology is actually changing us emotionally and even physically. I'm Guy Raz. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Stay with us. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And our show today, my robot, my friend, my enemy, the promise and the peril of how we relate to our technology. So, remember that little seal, Carl? Well, we wanted to meet a robot just like that. So, producer Brent Bachman and I took a little trip.
Hi, we're going to MIT?
To the MIT Media Lab, where we met some real robots. And in a room there, we saw a table with two little robots. Kind of looked like Teletubby versions of sunflowers. A small little screen right in the center of the flower. And they were kind of talking to each other. So on the other side of this lab, which is basically like a robot graveyard, except with gears and robot body parts sort of strewn about, on the other side, there was another robot. It was bigger, kind of R2-D2-sized, and that robot is called Nexi.
We're looking at basically like what looks like a bunch of metal on a chassis, and then this neck and shoulders and white head, these sort of large blue eyes, and it's kind of looking at me wistfully. So let me see what it does.
Nexi's two arms start moving.
Oh, wow.
And then...
Can I shake your hand?
Nexi, she looks right at me and says...
Hello. My name is Nexi, and I'm an MBS robot.
And as she's talking, Her eyebrows move up and down.
Because I can communicate in many of the ways that people do.
Her face, it changes. It changes to reflect emotions.
I can tell you that I'm sad.
And the corners of her mouth, they go down.
Mad.
Her eyebrows narrow.
Confused. Excited. Or even bored.
And the whole time?
It's like having a conversation with me right now.
Like, she's not just looking at me. She's seeing me.
But I hope you can see that I'm very happy to have met you. Thank you for visiting me, and I hope to see you again.
How do you create that feeling? Like you're not really talking to a pile of metal and circuit boards, but you're talking to something that understands you.
Hi.
Well, you start with this woman.
Oh, now I hear a big echo.
Cynthia Brazil.
Do you hear that echo?
She directs the Personal Robots Group at the MIT Media Lab, where she basically brings robots to life. Something she's wanted to do since she was a kid. When she saw Star Wars.
I wasn't that interested in seeing it initially. But once I was in the theater and you know that Imperial cruiser comes over at you, the iconic scene. And then these robots came on.
They shut down the main reactor. We'll be destroyed for sure.
My jaw just dropped. I couldn't believe it.
R2-D2, where are you?
I mean, they had emotions, and they were loyal sidekicks, and they helped people.
Is there anything I might do to help?
And they were amazing in their humanity, almost, right?
We seem to be made to suffer. It's our lot in life.
I was all about those robots.
And so, those robots from Star Wars?
They definitely led me, ultimately, to MIT.
And that's where, for the last 20 years, Cynthia Brazil has been building and studying social robots.
So what I've learned through building these systems...
Here's her TED Talk.
...is that robots are actually a really intriguing social technology, where it's actually their ability to push our social buttons and to interact with us like a partner that is a core part of their functionality. And with that shift in thinking, we can now start to imagine new questions, new possibilities for robots that we might not have thought about otherwise. But what do I mean when I say push our social buttons? Well, one of the things that we've learned is if we design these robots to communicate with us using the same body language, the same sort of nonverbal cues that people use, what we find is that people respond to robots a lot like they respond to people. People use these cues to determine things like how persuasive someone is, how likable, how engaging, how trustworthy. Turns out it's the same for robots.
Really? Is it the same for robots?
Well, I think the intriguing thing here is that, I mean, we are, as people, we are such a profoundly social species that when we interact with other people, the social judgments that we form, so do I like this person? Do I trust this person? Is this person credible? So much of that is established not just in what we say, but in many ways what our bodies are communicating. So it's a lot of this is around our nonverbal cues. And those nonverbal cues are processed both at a conscious level but also at a subconscious level. And what we're finding is that if you design other artifacts, you know, and people can do this with virtual avatars, and it turns out you can also do this with physical machines such as robots, if you design them in a way that adhere to those principles, then you can actually see very similar effects.
It's turning out now that robots are actually becoming a really interesting new scientific tool to understand human behavior, to answer questions like, how is it that from a brief encounter we're able to make an estimate of how trustworthy another person is? Mimicry is believed to play a role, but how? Is it mimicking of particular gestures that matter? It turns out it's really hard to learn this or understand this from watching people, because when we interact, we do all of these cues automatically. We can't carefully control them because they're subconscious for us. But with a robot, you can.
So, Nexi, the robot we met earlier?
Hello, my name is Nexi, and I'm an MBS robot.
One day she could get really good at reading and interpreting my nonverbal cues and responding to them. But how well? How good could Cynthia get at replicating us?
This is the interesting question, right? I mean, there definitely seems to be things that come into play that are just deep in how our brains work. But there are probably interesting differences, too. And I think a lot of the science and the research is really trying first to understand that, and then from an engineering level, trying to understand, well, how can you harness that to really help people?
Cynthia went over a few examples in her TED Talk. One example is that robots could be kind of like interactive Skype machines for people who live far apart.
So I imagine a time not too far from now, my mom can go to her computer, open up a browser and jack in to a little robot, and as kind of grandma bot, she can now play, really play with my sons, with her grandson, in the real world with his real toys.
Or sticking with kids, robot technology could be used in schools to make learning more engaging and interactive.
What I've been trying to do here is create a really immersive experience for kids where they really feel like they are part of that story, part of that experience, and I really want to spark their imaginations the way that mine was sparked as a little girl watching Star Wars.
Or one of the coolest experiments with these things, one that's already been tried. A robot. Like a personal trainer. But how many personal trainers speak that way? I am your personal trainer.
So we actually explored this idea in our lab. This is a robot, Autumn.
Hi, my name is Autumn.
That's Autumn's actual voice.
I'm a personal weight loss coach.
Corey could develop this robot for his doctoral work.
That's me.
And that's Corey Kidd. Corey Kidd, former student of Cynthia's.
Yeah, so I spent about 6.5 years at MIT. So that's where the Autumn Project came from.
And it was designed to be a robot diet and exercise coach. It had a couple of simple nonverbal skills it could do. It could make eye contact with you. It could share information looking down at a screen. You'd use the screen interface to enter information like how many calories you ate that day.
So for each breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, how many calories. And then either
how much exercise you got.
Or how many steps they had taken that day. So we gave everyone a pedometer.
And then it could help track that for you. And the robot spoke with a synthetic voice to engage you in a coaching dialogue.
With my daily support, I help you reach your goals and keep the weight off.
So an interesting question is, does the social embodiment really matter? Does it matter that it's a robot? Is it really just the quality of advice and information that matters? So to explore that question, we did a study in the Boston area where we put one of three interventions in people's homes for a period of several weeks.
So what we did is we enrolled 45 people, people who wanted to start a diet, and 15 of those people got Autumn.
Hi, my name is Autumn.
Another 15 got a computer with the same touchscreen interface as on the front of the robot. And the third group of 15 got what is still today's standard of care, the paper log.
So one of the things we really wanted to look at was not how much weight people lost, but really how long they interacted with the robot, because the challenge is not losing weight, it's actually keeping it off.
Right. The average diet lasts only 3.5 weeks. And so for that reason, we designed the study to be 6 weeks long. And we didn't intervene during the study. So after I dropped off either the paper log, the robot, or the computer, the next contact I had with people was at about 5.5 weeks, you know, giving them a call saying the study's about over. Can we schedule a follow-up visit to pick this up and do an interview with them? And you know, one of the things I found in those interviews was that most of the people with the robot named it. Many people dressed them up, hats and scarves. One of them had a red feather boa around her neck. No, she's become like a friend, you know. Can I keep her? I don't want to give her up. She's like a family member. They really developed a relationship with it.
And even when we would come up to pick up the robots at the end of the study, they would come out to the car and say goodbye to the robots. They didn't do this with the computer. Robots touch something deeply human within us. And so whether they're helping us to become creative and innovative, or whether they're helping us to feel more deeply connected despite distance, or whether they are our trusted psychic who's helping us attain our personal goals and becoming our highest and best selves, for me, robots are all about people. Thank you.
Earlier when we heard from Sherry Turkle, she told the story about watching this old woman interact with this robotic seal. And that moment was deeply unsettling. Not because she thinks robots are bad, but in a sense because she feels that in a way humans, people have failed.
You know, I think the challenge there is how you can design technologies that support our human social systems, right? So in the case of the old woman, you certainly would not want the case ever where all of her comfort could only be derived from artifacts of any kind, frankly, and not from human contact and not from family and loved ones, correct? So, You know, I think one of our design challenges is to always keep in mind our human values and how we preserve human dignity and our responsibility to each other, and recognize that technology can help. It can really help in profound ways, maybe in new ways that we still have to wrap our heads around.
Cynthia Brazil, she directs the Personal Robots Group at the MIT Media Lab. Check out her full TED Talk at TED.com. Hey, Andrew.
Hi.
Do you speak any languages?
I speak a bit of French.
Oh, okay, let me just do a real-time translation on my, my iPhone app here. Our next guest is another MIT professor named Andrew McAfee.
Notre prochain invité, un autre professeur du MIT, Andrew McAfee.
That's not bad.
It's getting there.
It's getting there. Andrew McAfee, we should mention, studies how technology, like this little app, affects economies.
I've been reliably assured by people at Google that within a few years, you'll be able to communicate fairly seamlessly when you travel with people who don't share a language with you. And right now, we think that's weird to imagine going to a different country, talking into our phones and having a conversation.
That's weird.
How long ago did we think it was weird to be walking down the street talking to apparently nobody? And now we all do that all the time because of our smartphones and our Bluetooth headsets and whatnot. So the weird becomes the normal with remarkable speed these days.
Andrew McAfee spends a lot of time thinking about that place between the weird and the normal. Between technology that's really useful and cool, like that $3 language app, and technology that might be a little too good. Kind of like in that movie WALL-E. You know, the little robot.
WALL-E's an incredibly sweet movie.
And WALL-E, you know, saves planet Earth from rampant consumerism, technology gone awry, basically. It is sweet, but it's kind of terrifying.
It's terrifying in a sense, that vision of, you know, morbidly obese people just consuming fast food and descending into shallow materialism is kind of a chilling vision of the future.
Accurate?
Let's hope not. That would be a bad way for us to go.
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, a lot of what you study has to do with what robots, not unlike WALL-E, are doing to the American workforce.
Well, if you look around at the economy, you start to see a lot of jobs that are squarely in the sights of the machines of today and tomorrow.
The percentage of Americans with jobs is at a 20-year low. Just a few years ago, if you traveled by air, you would have interacted with a human ticket agent. Bank tellers have given way to ATMs, sales clerks are surrendering to e-commerce, and switchboard operators and secretaries to voice recognition technology.
Either with mental work or with physical work, if you find yourself following instructions, doing much the same thing over and over again, that's a job that's squarely in the sights of automation.
So here's Andrew McAfee's TED Talk, where he asks the main question behind all of this.
Are the droids taking our jobs? And there's some evidence that they are. The Great Recession ended when American GDP resumed its kind of slow, steady march upward. Corporate profits are higher than they've ever been. And business investment in gear, in equipment, and hardware and software is at an all-time high. So the businesses are getting out their checkbooks. What they're not really doing is hiring. Just in the past couple years, we've seen digital tools display skills and abilities that they never, ever had before, and that kind of eat deeply into what we human beings do for a living. Let me give you a couple examples. Throughout all of history, if you wanted something written, a report or an article, you had to involve a person. Not anymore. This is an article that appeared in Forbes Online a while back about Apple's earnings. It was written by an algorithm.
Forbes earnings preview, Apple. Analysts have become increasingly bullish on Apple in the month leading up to the company's second quarter earnings announcement scheduled for Tuesday, April 24th.
And it's not decent, it's perfect.
The consensus earnings per share estimate has moved up from
We really appreciated that.
One of the guys who invented that algorithm? Christian Hammond.
I'm the CTO and one of the founders of Narrative Science.
It's a company that designs technology to do something you used to need a person for, to take a bunch of information and turn it into a story. So it's not like this technology can only write about stocks. Hammond thinks that
anywhere where there's a spreadsheet, any place where you get a chart, a graph, or a table, you know, the performance of your sales force, logistics, any organization you do business with. So the electric company, your cell phone company, what's going on with your usage and what you might be able to do to improve. All the areas where we are given numbers and we long for that moment of communication, where it's like, could someone please tell me what this means? We should exist there too.
And Chris says he runs into people every day who, for reasons they don't quite understand, are kind of unsettled by this.
It's because we want to be special. And when you look at the ability to express things in language, that seems to be one of our special things. I mean, if you would say, what separates us from the animals? One of the things would be language use. And it's just that happens to be not something that will now separate us from machines.
So if you're freaking out right now, or maybe you're not, maybe this doesn't worry you, but if it does, there is a light at the end of this journey, I promise. Just a bit more pain first, just a bit. This episode, My Robot, My Frenemy, How Our Technology is Changing the Way We Relate to Each Other. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz, back in a moment. It's a TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And we're talking about the promise and the peril of how we relate to technology. And that example we just heard about an algorithm writing a coherent article, doing something most of us thought only humans could do. Well, in his TED Talk, Andrew McAfee described a future like a near future where robots will do a lot more than any of us imagine.
They're starting to flex their muscles in the physical world as well. I had the chance a little while back to ride in the Google autonomous car, which is as cool as it sounds. And I will vouch that it handled the stop-and-go traffic on US 101 very smoothly. There are about 3.5 million people who drive trucks for a living in the United States. I think some of them are going to be affected by this technology. And right now, humanoid robots are still incredibly primitive. They can't do very much, but they're getting better quite quickly. And DARPA, which is the investment arm of the Defense Department, is trying to accelerate their trajectory. So in short, yeah, the droids are coming for our jobs. And managing that transition is going to be the greatest challenge that our society faces. Voltaire summarized why. He said, work saves us from three great evils, boredom, vice, and need.
It's scary, totally disruptive, and probably unstoppable. The potential for a huge oversupply of human labor with not much to do.
But despite this challenge, I'm still a huge digital optimist, and I am supremely confident that the digital technologies that we're developing now are going to take us into a utopian future, not a dystopian future. And to explain why, I want to pose kind of a ridiculously broad question. I want to ask, what have been the most important developments in human history? It's a wonderful question to ask and to start an endless debate about, because some people are going to bring up systems and philosophy in both the West and the East that have changed how a lot of people think about the world. And then some other folk will say, actually, what changes civilizations, what modifies them, and what changes people's lives are empires. So the great developments in human history are stories of conquest and of war. And then other people will say, no, actually, the big developments are the founding of the world's major religions, which have changed civilizations and have changed and influenced how countless people are living their lives. And then some cheery soul usually always pipes up and says, hey, don't forget about plagues. There are some optimistic answers to this question. So some people will bring up the age of exploration and the opening up of the world. Others will talk about intellectual achievements in disciplines like math that have helped us get a better handle on the world. And other folk will talk about periods when there was a deep flourishing of the arts and sciences. So this debate will go on and on. It's an endless debate, and there's no conclusive, no single answer to it. But if you're a geek like me, you say, well, what do the data say? And you start to do things like graph things that we might be interested in, the total worldwide population, for example, or some measure of social development or the state of advancement of a society. So when you do this and when you plot the data, you pretty quickly come to some weird conclusions. You conclude, actually, that none of these things have mattered very much. They haven't done a darn thing to the curves. There has been one story, one development in human history that bent the curve, bent it just about 90 degrees, and it is a technology story. The steam engine and the other associated technologies of the Industrial Revolution changed the world and influenced human history so much that, in the words of the historian Ian Morris, they made mockery out of all that had come before. And they did this by infinitely multiplying the power of our muscles, overcoming the limitations of our muscles. Now, what we're in the middle of now is overcoming the limitations of our individual brains and infinitely multiplying our mental power. How can this not be as big a deal as overcoming the limitations of our muscles? So as I look around at all the evidence and I think about the room that we have ahead of us, I become a huge digital optimist, and I start to think that we right now have the great good fortune to be living at a time when digital technology is flourishing, when it is broadening and deepening and becoming more profound all around the world. So yeah, the droids are taking our jobs, but focusing on that fact misses the point entirely. The point is that then we are freed up to do other things. And what we're going to do, I am very confident, what we're going to do is reduce poverty and drudgery and misery around the world. I'm very confident we're going to learn to live more lightly on the planet. And I am extremely confident that what we're going to do with our new digital tools is going to be so profound and so beneficial that it's going to make a mockery out of everything that came before.
What if we do such a good job at this that it makes us irrelevant?
You know, it will make some workers irrelevant, and that I am concerned about. I am not concerned with technology making humanity irrelevant, making human connection irrelevant, making families irrelevant, making love irrelevant. I'm just not bothered about that.
Hold me close and hold me fast. Andrew McAfee, he's a research scientist at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He and Eric Brynjolfsson, who also gave a TED Talk at TED 2013 in Long Beach, wrote the book Race Against the Machine. You can see Andrew's full TED Talk at ted.npr.org.
Well, what if we all look like those people in WALL-E, you know, like a few hundred years from now, or maybe 100 years from now? That'd be a problem.
Yeah, that would be a bad outcome. There's a wonderful guy who spent his career at MIT. He's one of just the real institutions of the Institute. His name was Norbert Wiener. And he had a great quote that the world of the future is not going to be a comfortable hammock in which we lie down to be waited on by our robot slaves. I hope he's right, because the WALL-E vision of the future is exactly that, that we just have these comfortable hammocks and our robot slaves take care of us, and as a result, we literally get really fat and really lazy. Let's hope that's not the world we're headed into.
So everything we've been hearing so far is like one long wind-up to Dr. Abraham Verghese.
Yes, speaking.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, it's Verghese as in geese.
And Abraham Verghese specializes in infectious disease.
I am a senior associate chair of the Department of Medicine at Stanford.
And he works with the absolute best medical technology in the world. And when he gave his TED Talk, he started with this story.
I tell the story of this woman who came into a hospital close by where she came in an extremist. Her blood pressure was an alarming 230 over 170. Within a few minutes, she went into cardiac collapse. They quickly resuscitated her and stabilized her, the miracles of modern medicine, and rushed her to the CAT scan suite because they were concerned about blood clots in the lung or some other catastrophic reason for her circulatory collapse. And the CAT scan revealed it was not that she had blood clots, but it showed visible bilateral palpable breast tumors that had metastasized all over the body. And the great tragedy is that she had been seen in various healthcare settings four or five times in the preceding 2 years.
Four or five opportunities to see the breast masses, touch the breast mass, intervene at a much earlier stage than when we saw her. Ladies and gentlemen, that is not an unusual story. Unfortunately, it happens all the time. I joke, but I only half joke, that if you come to one of our hospitals missing a limb, no one will believe you till they get a CAT scan, MRI, or orthopedic consult. This may actually be heresy to say this at TED, but I'd like to introduce you to the most important innovation, I think, in medicine to come in the next 10 years, and that is the power of the human hand to touch, to comfort, to diagnose, and to bring about treatment.
Hey, robots, are you listening? Dr. Verghese does something you cannot.
I think, you know, in our sophistication, sometimes we forget that one timeless aspect of our profession has been of that kind of level of reassurance and comfort, which I think will never quite go away. I had an interesting debate with a well-heeled and very knowledgeable venture capital sort of person who, you know, has access to all kinds of information about illness and really was trying to make the case with me that they will not need to be a physician in a short time. It'll all be accessible to us by computers. And I was thinking, as you said, that you just haven't suffered enough. When you suffer enough, what you want, especially in addition to your best technology, best chemo, you also want a caring, empathetic physician who really expresses concern for you. And I think that aspect is why I came up with that phrase, that the most important innovation in the next decade will be recognizing the power of the human hand, not just to diagnose, but to comfort, to reassure, and to say, I will walk this path with you to the end of the line. I'll be with you. That is very important.
So when he gave his TED talk, Abraham Verghese tells a story about another doctor and the human touch. And that doctor's name was Joseph Bell. He was a professor of medicine at the University of Edinburgh.
So picture Bell sitting in the outpatient department, students all around him, patients signing up in the emergency room and being registered and being brought in. And a woman comes in with a child, and Conan Doyle describes the following exchange. The woman says, good morning. Bell says, what sort of crossing did you have on the ferry from Burnt Island? She says, it was good. And he says, what did you do with the other child? She says, I left him with my sister at Leith. And he says, and did you take the shortcut down Inverleith Row to get here to the infirmary? She says, I did. And he says, would you still be working at the linoleum factory? And she says, I am. And Bell then goes on to explain to the students. He says, you see, when she said good morning, I picked up her Fife accent, and the nearest ferry crossing from Fife is from Burnt Island, and so she must have taken the ferry over. You notice that the coat she's carrying is too small for the child who is with her, and therefore she started out the journey with two children, but dropped one off along the way. You notice the clay on the soles of her feet. Such red clay is not found within 100 miles of Edinburgh, except in the botanical gardens, and therefore she took a shortcut down Inverleith Row to arrive here. And finally, she has a dermatitis on the fingers of her right hand, a dermatitis that is unique to the linoleum factory workers in Burnt Island. And when Bell actually strips the patient, begins to examine the patient, you can only imagine how much more he would discern. And as a teacher of medicine, as a student myself, I was so inspired by that story. But you might not realize that our ability to look into the body in this simple way, using our senses, is quite recent. The picture I'm showing you is of Leopold Ohnrüger, who in the late 1700s discovered percussion. And the story is that Leopold Ohnrüger was the son of an inn keeper, and his father used to go down into the basement to tap on the sides of casks of wine to determine how much wine was left and whether to reorder. And so when Ohnrüger became a physician, he began to do the same thing. He began to tap on the chests of his patients, on their abdomens. And basically everything we know about percussion, which you can think of as an ultrasound of its day, organ enlargement, fluid around the heart, fluid in the lungs, abdominal changes, all of this he described in this wonderful manuscript, Inventum Novum, New Invention, which would have disappeared into obscurity except for the fact that this physician, Corvisart, a famous French physician, famous only because he was physician to this gentleman. Corvisart repopularized and reintroduced the work, and it was followed a year or two later by Laennec discovering the stethoscope. Laennec, it is said, was walking in the streets of Paris and saw two children playing with a stick. One was scratching at the end of the stick. Another child listened at the other end. And Laennec thought this would be a wonderful way to listen to the chest or listen to the abdomen using what he called the cylinder. Later he renamed it the stethoscope. And that is how stethoscope and auscultation was born. So within a few years, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, all of a sudden, the barber surgeon had given way to the physician who was trying to make a diagnosis.
And then rapidly after that followed things like the EKG and angiograms and then CAT scans and MRI. But only the hand can tell where it's tender, where the patient winces. That's only the sort of thing that a human hand and a discerning observer can make out.
Back in the mid-1980s, at the height of the AIDS crisis, Abraham Verghese would make the rounds at the hospital where he worked, and it was like a death chamber. Everyone inside was dead or close to dying.
I remember every time I went to a patient's deathbed, whether in the hospital or at home, I remember my sense of failure, the feeling of I don't know what I have to say, I don't know what I can say, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And out of that sense of failure, I remember I would always examine the patient. I would pull down the eyelid, I would look at the tongue, I would percuss the chest, I would listen to the heart, I would feel the abdomen, and then the next day I would come and I would do it again. And I wanted to read you this one closing passage about one patient. I recall one patient who was at that point no more than a skeleton encased in shrinking skin, unable to speak. When he saw me on what turned out to be his last hours on this earth, his hands moved as if in slow motion. And as I wondered what he was up to, his stick fingers made their way up to his pajama shirt, fumbling with his buttons. I realized that he was wanting to expose his wicker basket chest to me. It was an offering, an invitation. I did not decline. I percussed. I palpated. I listened to the chest. I think he surely must have known by then that it was vital for me just as it was necessary for him. Neither of us could skip this ritual, which had nothing to do with detecting rales in the lung or finding the gallop rhythm of heart failure. No, this ritual was about the one message that physicians have needed to convey to their patients. Although God knows of late in our hubris, we seem to have drifted away. We seem to have forgotten. As if with the explosion of knowledge, the whole human genome mapped out at our feet, we are lulled into inattention, forgetting that the ritual is cathartic to the physician, necessary for the patient, forgetting that the ritual has meaning and a singular message to convey to the patient. And the message, which I didn't fully understand then, even as I delivered it, and which I understand better now, is this: I will always, always, always be there. I will see you through this. I will never abandon you. I will be with you through the end. Thank you very much.
Dr. Abraham Verghese. His full TED Talk is called The Human Touch, and you can find it at ted.npr.org. So with all that amazing, incredible, wondrous technology being developed, technology that will really change the way we relate to each other, we're still limited. There are things technology will never be able to replicate, like the human soul and the human touch. And there's something reassuring about that. Don't you think?
We talk like machines with moving parts and electric chains.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, you can visit ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com. And you can download this program through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Megan Kane, Brent Bachman, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Portia Robertson-Migas and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading. and the TED Radio Hour from NPR.